Military Mondays with David Katz.
Major David Katz, a very good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Howard. What's there not to be happy about?
Exactly. Linda says, good morning, Mayhem team. Things are so dull around here that I'm actually excited about the approaching cold front.
Oh, wow.
I love that. Oh. I love that. No, because, yeah, I hear it. Like you, like,
something different.
You're
anything
in lockdown,
different.
Anything different.
Any change
exactly.
is welcome.
Exactly. And they say Joburg's a hotspot. David Katz. So we, of course, are talking about social distancing. And in the military world, I guess that cyber attacks and cyber warfare is the ultimate in social distancing.
I don't know where that's leading to. I suppose once the attack has taken place and it's disrupted everything, I suppose that is the ultimate in,
no,
in,
because
in
you could sit
social media distancing. Yes. Probably when everything gets switched off,
right? But we've seen an incredible spate of cyber warfare and cyber attacks happening all over the world in the last, especially what Iran and Israel in particular, over the last couple of weeks. It's really is it the new frontier?
Well, certainly, I think we must make a definition of what exactly it entails. So certainly it's a conflict between two states. It's not a conflict between a couple of people. It has to be a conflict between two states. And just as in normal warfare, it can be conducted through proxy hackers. And it can become become one of those proxy wars. So certainly it's a threat. I don't know if there's been an example of an outright cyber war that we've seen. Examples of them are very, very few and far between. So certainly there have been forays into it, and I suppose there have been skirmishes, but full-scale attacks I don't think we've seen yet.
Mm. So, I mean, does warfare move into that, or does it stay? Is it always going to stay sort of boots on the ground and very, very physical?
No, certainly not. I mean, in warfare, there's a toolbox of tools that you can use in warfare, and cyber warfare forms one of the very, very important parts of what warfare will look like right now and in the future. I don't think it's going to replace the normal signs of conventional warfare by any means, but it's just another dimension to add. It's the third and fourth dimension to warfare that gets added, makes things more complicated. So certainly, I don't think it signifies an end to anything. It certainly signifies a beginning and just another aspect of warfare.
Do these things happen parallel? In other words, the wars that are very traditional and very much hands-on, I would imagine, like that in Afghanistan and those areas, or do you have a merging of the two?
Certainly, things develop in parallel, and things also are diverse, and they develop separately. So all things are happening all at once at the same time. When we have a look at guerrilla type warfare, depending on the sophistication of the guerrillas that you're fighting, they will be less or more susceptible to cyber warfare. I mean, you can just imagine the Taliban walking around the Tora Bora in Afghanistan. I don't even know if they've got cell phones. Yeah. I mean, they are absolutely impervious to cyber type warfare. But I'm sure they've got arms and divisions that engage in cyber warfare and are very, very interested in it. But for the normal conventional Taliban or guerrilla soldier out there with boots on the ground at the end of the day, I don't know how susceptible he's going to be to cyber warfare. So it depends. The more sophisticated your army is, and the more sophisticated your economy is. I mean, in Western society, everybody's sort of plugged into a computer system these days. Everything's dependent. I mean, the electrical grids out there, the power grids, the airports, everything's run on a computer system. So you can imagine what happens if those systems are interrupted or destroyed or disrupted, how that can bring down an economy, how that can bring down a military. And the more, can I use the word backward, the more backward your military is and less dependent it is on electronic items, the less it's going to be affected by cyber warfare.
Yeah, it is interesting because, and I guess the more susceptible, then the more you've almost got to have the more susceptible you are to cyber warfare or damage, you've got to have the old-fashioned or traditional backup, which is key to this.
Well, not only have you got to have the old-fashioned backup, but you've got to have the new-fashioned backup. You've got to have teams of people making sure that your systems are safe. Inventing viral antivirus type software that we're used to using in our homes, also ensuring that passwords are changed, and you know, just continuously upgrading upgrading the systems against an attack. But also that's on your defensive front. Then you're going to have an offensive front that goes out there and invents new types of viruses and systems that will attack a future enemy's computer grid.
Very, very interesting. There's another subject I wanted to talk to you about. Today in history, today, May the 25th, in 1944, it was the first time the word apartheid was used in Parliament by D.F. Malan. So today, May the 25th, in 1944, was the first time that the word apartheid was ever used in Parliament, which I found quite fascinating. But around about this time of year as well is Jan Smuts's birthday. He would have been, 150, I think.
Oh.
Jan Smuts was born on the 24th of May. He would have been 150. He actually died on the 29th of May. So the two dates straddle where we are now. So
yesterday was Jan Smuts's birthday. He was an intriguing character, wasn't he?
Listen, absolutely intriguing. And I think what's more intriguing, for such a statesman, for somebody who was during his time was so recognized internationally, and nationally for that matter, that he doesn't really have much of a legacy left in South Africa, and certainly not internationally.
He doesn't even have an airport anymore.
He used to have an airport in the name. That's been taken away many, many years ago, old Jan Smuts Airport.
He has a raised at Rhodes University.
Oh, he has he's got a road.
Yes.
He's got a road somewhere. Has he still got Jan Smuts, right?
Yes.
Or has that been changed?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
So he's got that. He's got a couple of other little things going along. Oh, and hold on, wait. I forget. He's got a regiment now named after him, which was a regiment in the new naming process that took place about 6 or 7 months ago. So that has sort of been recognized, but it goes against the flow of what's happened with his legacy, where he's not really that recognized. He's forgotten. And I don't think he forms a useful part of the current democratic regime.
So that's what I'm interested in. Tell us, was he a good guy, a bad guy, both?
Well, it's difficult to say. First of all, I think we have to be careful with these things. We need to judge a man by the standards of his times. We can't be anachronistic. So we've got to judge him by those times. And even if when we judge him by those times, certainly he was a genius. I mean, we all know about that. I'm not going to rehash that he had a fantastic education. He did very, very well. He was recognized intellectually as being superior to many, many people of those times. But he had opportunities. I think his biggest failings, he had two biggest failings. And the first one was that he failed to take care of black political aspirations in South Africa. He had a few opportunities during his career, which was a long career. I mean, it spanned many, many years. And he missed the boat on a couple of opportunities to take care of black political aspirations, which would have put us on a better footing than where we were after his government fell in 1948. The second issue was that he had a fallout with Afrikaners because of his conciliation policy, where he tried to bring Afrikaners and Englishmen together and unite them. It almost had the opposite effect of alienating a large proportion of the Afrikaner population, who later became your nationalists. And certainly they don't hold him in high esteem. So because of these two events, because of his adverse reckoning with the Afrikaner people, and also because of his irrelevance to the struggle in South Africa, his legacy is almost forgotten.
So that is fascinating, that he was almost maybe too liberal for the time, and in fact that ultimately did damage to the path that South Africa would follow.
If I had to compare him to somebody that we know currently, I mean, he's been compared on some fronts to Thabo Mbeki. Both men are considered intellectual, but they're a little aloof. They were a little bit arrogant. They were more worried about the international state of affairs than local affairs. So they were more in touch with what was going on internationally than back on the home front. And this alienated a large proportion of the local population away from these guys, where they were absolutely hallowed overseas, and recognized overseas for their international statesmanship and that type of thing. So it's, they're quite tragic figures at the end of the day, because they are, they have played an immense part in world affairs, and, that legacy that we should embrace, because it's pretty misunderstood. The first thing you said to me this morning was he a good guy? Or was he a bad guy? It's difficult to sort of pigeonhole people into, you know, some aspects of him were, there's a lot of gray about Smuts. I mean, he was outstanding in many, many ways. Outstanding. And in many ways, he had shortcomings. He was just a normal human being who reached great, great heights, and we should embrace him as one of our leaders, and we should celebrate his existence.
Mm. It's just fascinating because, as you said, it's almost that the current environment doesn't quite know how to deal with him. They don't really know where to place him, because I guess he's a colonialist, which already makes him bad, but yet he was, he clearly did it's some good. I know as it wasn't he the important factor as well with South Africa joining the Allies, before the Second World, in the Second World War.
No, absolutely. Certainly what you, when you talk about his, meeting his obligations to the Commonwealth, to the empire, it cost him a hell of a lot back home with Afrikaner support. He ensured that we entered the First World War on the Allied side, and it was touch and go with that. I must tell you, there was the whole Afrikaner rebellion. He put down the Afrikaner rebellion as a direct result of us entering into the First World War. So he took many, many political risks to show loyalty to the empire and to come in on the Allied side. He repeated that again in the Second World War. And certainly it cost him politically, to do that. When you talk about his relevance, it more goes to his, what do we do with this man? Well, why is he relevant? I mean, the borders that we live in today are a direct result of Jan Smuts's efforts. He formed the Union of South Africa in 1910, and it almost describes the borders that we have today. And without a man like him, we wouldn't have been the country that we are. Certainly we wouldn't be living in the side of the borders that he described. So he's made many, many contributions, but these have been sort of subsumed in the general overall picture that they say he was a colonialist. In fact, he fought against the British Empire in the Boer War. He was a general in the Boer War fighting against them. And in a remarkable switch, I mean, he turned around and became a loyal a member of the Commonwealth. In fact, a leader of the British Empire. So
and Michael
all aspects
says,
that we should be looking at.
Michael says, wasn't one of his greatest mistakes turning the army on mine workers during the reef mine worker strike?
No, absolutely. He was seen, he was pretty callous at times. And that callousness and aloofness cost him a lot of support. He put to death a certain person called Joppy Faurie. Now, if you speak to a lot of Afrikaners today, they all remember about Joppy Faurie. Joppy Faurie was one of the commanders that went out on rebellion, and he never gave up his membership to the Union Defence Force. So therefore, he was tried for treason, found guilty, and Smuts put him to death. And he was just not in touch with the general feeling. I mean, it cost him a lot doing that. He was technically correct. The man was a traitor, but he didn't read the political situation correctly and was heavy-handed with that. And that was one of the turning points of turning the Afrikaners against him. And then again, you're 100% right. In 1913 and 1940, he put down the Rand strikes very heavy-handedly, and then sent six of the strikers back to the United Kingdom. I mean, totally illegally, he did something like that. And then again, the 1922 strikes. So he was a little tone-deaf when it came to being in touch with the general feeling of the population.
There was a South African a book written fairly recently on his life. I mean, I know there's been many, but one that was apparently meant to be very good. What do you recommend that people read if they want to read more about Jan Smuts?
Well, I think there's nothing to beat. There have been a couple of books that have come through over the last couple of years. There has been a revitalization. And certainly there's been an attempt by some Afrikaners to reclaim him back into the Afrikaner fold. But my best recommendation is a guy called Keith Hancock, who wrote a book back, two books in fact, back in 1960. And quite difficult to get hold of his books. But if you really want to know about Jan Smuts and the inner workings of what happened over his 50 years span of being in politics and a soldier, this is the book to get. There's two volumes, as I say, pretty expensive, right. Out of print, difficult to get, but there's nothing to touch it.
Amazing. Very, very interesting indeed. Linda says, history is sad but fascinating and interesting that it's a pity to that bound to repeat itself. Major David Katz, thank you as always. Fascinating conversation. We'll catch you next week.